Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage and get a secure, transparent home loan approval in minutes. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Well, the president's first budget is finally in, and it's big. Big cuts to Medicare, anti-poverty programs, education, science research, and a lot more. Big tax cuts for the wealthiest. New funding for the big Mexico wall is in there. And finally, a big confident promise that the economy will grow and grow and pay for it all. This hour on Point, the president fires his salvo and the budget battle ahead. You can join us on air or online. Are you excited to see a change in Washington's spending priorities? Are you worried about creating new holes in the nation's safety net? The Trump administration says this budget is compassionate, but Hillary Clinton calls it unimaginable cruelty. Where do you fall? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Nicholas Johnston. He's editor of the online media company Axios, and he keeps a sharp eye on the federal budget. Nicholas, thanks for being with us. Welcome to On Point.
It's great to be here.
Great. So let's just dig into it with you for a moment.
Sure.
Everyone knows that budgets lay out presidents' priorities. What does this budget tell us about President Trump's priorities?
These are definitely the way I like to describe budgets like this are. They are aspirational political documents. They are the first chance for the president to write in very specific, down to, you know, millions of dollars, the priorities that they laid out during the campaign to try and begin to build a policy and a spending framework around this. You mentioned at the top of the hour that this is a sharp departure from President Obama's budget. Well, President Trump is a very sharp departure from President Obama. And I think we're going to see that here, that at the priorities you laid out, focusing on border security, focusing on defense, an aspiration to balance the budget in 10 years with some very sharp cuts, like you said, $800 billion to Medicaid, cuts to many other programs such as that. And then also assumptions that the president, that Congress will go ahead and overhaul health care and that tax reform will be passed as a way to encourage revenue. So, President Trump won the election. He is now president, and he has now released a very large document detailing very specifically his policy and spending goals for his administration.
Let's get a little more specific. What is the headline on health care?
The health care is – well, first, I think the headline is a policy headline instead of a spending headline, in that it assumes that the House's the repeal and replace of Obamacare will happen. That hasn't happened yet. They're just a part of the way there through that in the House. On the second part of health care, I think it is the large cuts to Medicaid, the $800 billion, like you mentioned, and then the additional cut to other entitlement programs such as that. I mean, I think that is the definitely big headline. I think what people have jumped on most quickly in the start of this, and this is what sort of my colleague Jonathan Swan scooped on Sunday morning before the budget was out, was $1.7 trillion in entitlement cuts over 10 years. That's a huge number. That is a big headline number. I think that they came out with on the budget.
Can you help us understand what are some of these entitlement cuts? The names of the programs.
Right. SNAP, one of my friends here might be able to tell me exactly what that's
food stamps.
Commonly known as food stamps.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Cuts to that, cuts to some of the assistance programs for children's health insurance, changes to some of the Social Security disability programs. Just like very broadly going after, not going after, but sort of like cutting the spending in some of these entitlement programs. However, I will say that keeping up to his campaign promise, there are no changes more broadly to Social Security or Medicare, the health insurance for elderly.
Right. But Medicaid does say take a significant hit in this. We'll come back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
There's also some trims in the science front and the EPA.
Right. Yeah. Right. Smaller spending amounts, but across the board in many of these programs, in these discretionary funds, such as the NIH and the CDC and the EPA, there are large cuts. State Department as well in all of this. These are things that the president has proposed cutting before this came out in what was known as the skinny budget,
right.
Prior announcement, sort of an intermediary spending plan to cut many of these programs. These have already run into opposition on the Hill. None of those cuts have gone through, I don't think, yet, and they face the same sort of opposition. But
in addition to
the broad cuts, there's all these sort of individual program cuts as well.
Let's get back to that in a moment. I want to talk for one beat about some of the spending increases. So this does allocate a fair amount of new money both for military and for the wall.
Right. There is some money for the wall. It's broadly under border security that the increased security, hiring more officers to patrol the border, increasing technology on the border. There is a down payment for funding for the wall. I know there's a very contentious political issue in Washington of who will be paying for that. The president since said eventually Mexico will pay for it, but there is sort of a beginning on that. I mean, as I said sort of at the top, this is a reflection of his priorities. And the priorities, as he said on the campaign, is rebuilding the military. There's a amount of money for defense in there. Taking border security very seriously. There's a lot of money for that in there. There's also money for veterans. And so this is him putting sort of like the dollar figures on where these campaign promises were.
And the White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney is going to be testifying on the Hill any minute now. So we'll hear a little bit more of the rationale behind some of these cuts, and we'll update as we get information. Pulling back for a moment, how would Trump's voters be impacted by many of these policy changes were they to happen?
Right. We're looking at a lot of people, including Axios and a lot of other good journalists, are sort of trying to dig through these numbers to figure out where these cuts would occur. And there is perhaps a little bit of a disconnect in that a lot of voters who were upset with the economy leaving them behind, who may benefit from some of these programs, may be impacted by those. I know that is an objection that I think will be raised by people who oppose these cuts. One comment that stood out to me very clearly on the Hill was Hal Rogers, a senior Republican on appropriations, who called the entitlement cuts draconian, which gave me a sense that his district voted for Trump, of course, but even he thought these cuts were somewhat too strong. So I think there is a lot of debate that's going to happen about sort of where these cuts fall and how Trump voters may be impacted by them.
Right. And specifically, the argument is a lot of these programs could benefit some of Trump's lower income, out of work or struggling for work voters.
I think that's exactly the argument people opposing the cuts will make.
So if you'll hold for 1 minute, I'd like to turn now to somebody well outside of Washington whose work brings her face to face daily with some of these issues with public education and the social safety net. Joining us from Asheville, North Carolina is Allison Jordan. She's executive director of an organization called Children First Communities in Schools, which serves school children in Buncombe County. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Hello.
Hi. Can you give us a look from ground level? How will these cuts, were they to be enacted, impact the community you serve?
Yeah, so we believe we connect students and their families to resources for improved health, resiliency, and academic achievement. And our services, such as communities and schools, student support specialists that are working in schools daily, we have after-school learning centers, and an AmeriCorps team, they complement and enhance children's public school experience. And they're needed because children are not born on equal footing. Our services close the gap that children did not ever choose to occupy. And so make no mistake, this proposed budget undercuts opportunities for children. It limits their access to health services and care. It weakens our public schools. It's taking food off of the children's plates. You've already talked about SNAP and food stamps. And it undercuts housing affordability. And so it's erasing gains that we've made to prevent future and more costly issues like poor health, low graduation rates, and homelessness.
So let me detail some of these changes. $627 billion cut to Medicaid, $194 billion cut to food stamps, $87 billion cut to National Institutes of Health. That's over a 10-year budget. Can you give us the story, Allison, of maybe one family or one child you've seen who's relied on food stamps or on children's health insurance and how their lives would change were those services not available?
Yes. And so, you know, what we know is that you can't play politics with children's health. And an example of that is a student that our communities and schools student support specialist was working with in elementary school. The child's mother passed away at the beginning of the year, and the child was living with their grandmother. The child thanks to Medicaid, already had a pair of glasses, but as children often do, they broke their glasses and they were not eligible for a second pair within the 12-month period. So our student support specialist worked with the grandmother and used the resources that we have access to and walked her through that process to purchase another pair of glasses for this student so the little boy could be successful in school. So he could, you know, I don't know if you wear glasses, but I do and certainly did as a kid, and they are an important piece to being successful in our daily lives, particularly in education. This is a child that was on free and reduced lunch and whose family also received food stamps. And we're dealing with a very tragic, sad moment in their lives, as well as having to live with all of the things that daily life, that their daily life brought to them on top of that.
Absolutely. You know, as many stories as there are out there, there's always a counter to them. And it's a tragic story you're telling us. I think that there are folks in Washington who would say, and even at the White House, that many of these programs could be handled by the private sector. And at times they're abused by people who don't need them. And the cost is carried by neighbors paying heavy taxes. So what is your reaction to an official saying, look, we have to reduce the tax burden on their neighbors, they can turn to private charity for this support?
So for the kind of public-private partnerships that we leverage at Children First Communities and Schools to work, for our work to be successful, we have many partnerships ranging with local colleges, businesses, churches and synagogues, school systems, and other nonprofit organizations. And for our work to work, we need strong public schools and health systems. When our budgets are focused on expanding opportunity and preventing future problems, it sets the table for successful community involvement so that we can improve our child well-being and increase school readiness and success.
All right. Nicholas, if you could just address in quick 20 seconds, I'm sure members of Congress are hearing comments like that all the time, and it's on their mind.
Right. But I'll just really quickly say what Mick Mulvaney said at the start. This is a taxpayer-friendly budget, but I think it's the approach they're taking.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. Budget Director Mick Mulvaney says the White House's first budget will be more equitable, grow the economy, and make average Americans more responsible. We're talking about all that. You can join the conversation. Do you think the president's plan to slash social programs is what this country needs? Are you pleased to see a spending increase for the military? How about the changes at the EPA? And how do you want Congress to react? My guests are Nicholas Johnston, editor of the online journal Axios and former managing editor at Bloomberg, and Allison Jordan, executive director of Children First Communities in Schools in Buncombe County, North Carolina. I'd like to start by going to the phone lines. Wilson is calling in with a comment from Beaufort, South Carolina. Wilson, what's on your mind?
Hi, Jessica. I just think that I would like to see a balance. I haven't seen directly what President Trump's budget is on the Medicaid cuts, but I think that those of us that pay our own way, and I'm all for helping the poor, I think a lot of people live off of the government, in other words, other people's money, because it seems to be too easy. And I think that's part of how Trump was elected, is people like myself just want to see more of a balance in how taxpayer dollars are distributed out to people that don't necessarily choose to make great financial decisions and just live off of other people's money.
Wilson, thanks for the call. Allison, would you respond to that? This is sort of the key Trump voter. He's addressing the concerns of taxpayers who feel that they are carrying other people.
Well, what I know is that we need to create a strong foundation for children to thrive, and that we can't isolate aspects of a child's life, that it is all interrelated, and therefore we must support all of it. And an example of that is Medicaid, that when children are enrolled on Medicaid, it helps them grow up to reach their full potential. They're missing fewer school days due to illness or injury. They're doing better in school. They're more likely to graduate high school and attend college and grow up to be healthier as adults. And then as adults, they're able to earn higher wages and ultimately pay more in taxes. So So Medicaid helps children grow up to reach their full potential and be thriving adults.
Nicholas, we should make clear that some of these cuts are already imagined in the health care bill that was passed by the House.
Right. I would say that all these cuts are imagined at the start. The $800 billion in Medicaid cuts is a bill that has passed the House already but not gone anywhere in the Senate. And all of these things are sort of proposals that are flying around. But I think a key point, like a hesitation I have about talking about the budget, is it is very aspirational. This is the first part of the beginning of the start of the first step of a very long process that will go to the Hill, and people will hear from their members of Congress, will hear from their constituents complaining about this is too much, this is too little, and it is a very long process to be worked through. What we see today will be very different when and if it ever becomes actual law later this year.
I want to listen now to the White House budget director, Mick Mulvaney, who spoke yesterday and pushed back at critics who say the budget shows a lack of compassion by cutting programs for those in need. He says that compassion cuts both ways.
We haven't spent nearly enough time focusing our attention on the people who pay the taxes. I got a couple questions yesterday. I know I will today about compassion. Compassion needs to be on both sides of that equation. Yes, you have to have compassion for folks who are receiving the federal funds, but also you have to have compassion for the folks who are paying it.
Allison, if you had a message for Mr. Mulvaney, what would it be?
I would say that I think President Trump's budget is misguided, and that I would call on Congress to put forward a budget that promotes opportunity and uplifts community partnerships. As I mentioned earlier, children are not born on equal footing, and we need services and programs that close the gap that children did not choose to occupy.
Allison, I'm grateful for your time. That's Allison Jordan, Executive Director of Children First Communities and Schools in North Carolina. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks.
Nicholas, I'm going to take another call, and I'd like you to give a little bit of a thought to how you would address this. Bill is calling in from Austin, Texas.
Sure.
Bill, what's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi.
I'm involved. Thank you. I'm involved here in Austin in a program that provides kids a place to go after school. And it provides help with homework and provides a snack and basically just a safe place to go. And it works. The kids graduate from high school at a 99% rate. Many more kids go to college than their peers.
Bill, do you have a comment on the budget?
Yeah, I do. I feel like programs for young people are an investment as opposed to a cost. And I think the budget looks at it like an expense item.
Got it.
We're investing in our own future.
Bill, thank you for the call. You know, Nicholas, what I was hoping he was going to, what I thought he was going to ask, and I'd like you to address,
sure,
is this has a lot of rosy assumptions about growth. The budget, as imagined, assumes that we're going to almost double our output. Is this a realistic economic assessment?
Right. Just as I was walking in the studio here, I read an analysis from Fitch, the ratings firm, which called the numbers somewhat optimistic. 3% growth is higher than we've seen in the United States for at least probably another decade. The administration responds that some of the policy changes they'll make will encourage growth, that failing to think the United States will grow at 3% shows a lack of optimism in the United States. I think all administrations make certain assumptions in their budgets. They want to sort of create a narrative, create data that will show them achieving their goals. Everyone tries to balance the budget 10 or 15 years out in the future, and I don't think anyone's achieved that in about 20 years. But the general consensus among economists that we've spoken to is that the 3% level is somewhat optimistic.
All right. Let's take another call. David is calling from Elizabethtown, Kentucky. David, what's on your mind?
Yes. I was calling because, well, first of all, I want to say that I completely disagree with cutting children's health insurance, like putting cuts to that. But as a taxpayer, last year our business ended up profiting, my our family-owned business, about $750,000. We paid almost like 40% in taxes. And because of that, we scaled back this year. There's no reason for us to expand our business if we're just putting out so much money in taxes. And by the time we pay workman's comp and everything, it really just, it puts a toll on our business.
So you're happy to see the tax cuts. Thank you for the call, David. That is the big push-pull, Nicholas, in here. On one hand, there's a lot of excitement among the base for among Trump's base for the tax cuts, I imagine. But how well are these proposed social services cuts being received even by Republicans in Congress?
As I mentioned, sort of some Republicans have called it draconian. Other Republicans, I know Senator John Cornyn, the number two Republican of the House, called the budget dead on arrival. Of course, he clarified saying that all budgets are dead on arrival because Congress gets to work its own. There is a lot of pushback, I think, among some Republicans on certain parts of the cuts. But I think what the callers have shown is just nailing it dead on the debate always about the budget between taxes and spending and the shift in the United States between some people who think their taxes are too high and others who really rely on sort of some of these programs. And, you know, this is the difficult job of governance and politics to make these decisions, to decide how much that business owner should pay in taxes to support that program for youths in Texas. I mean, that's what we're going to see being fought out this year on Congress and next year and forever.
I'd like to bring two more voices into the conversation. With us now from Washington is Romina Baca. I hope I said that right. Deputy Director of the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Economic Policy Studies. Romina, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also in Washington, Harry Stein, Director of Fiscal Policy at the Center for American Progress. Harry, welcome to you too.
Good to be on.
Romina, let's start with you. We know this is just a starting point. It will be redone, maybe even tossed out and start again. But your overall reaction to the president's budget?
I think the focus on reviving economic growth in this country is important because that is something that can create opportunities for all Americans, create jobs, opportunities for business growth. But the devil is, as so often, in the details. I do think it's great that the administration seeks to balance in 10 years, but we do need to look at some of the numbers that get them there. Overall, I also think we have to have, I think it starts an important conversation over the proper role of the federal government versus what state and local governments should be responsible, and also areas that should fall squarely within the private sector. So I like the direction the budget takes there. I am dismayed that we did not see Medicare reforms or Social Security reforms more broadly, because you cannot achieve long-term sustainable balance without addressing 40% of our annual budget, and that's Medicare and Social Security. So I'm hopeful that the president, as he continues to work on his budgets, will be able to move in that direction and embrace reforms to these programs that will enhance quality access to care, but do so at lower cost. And we know premium support can do that.
All right, Romina, a lot there. Let me begin with your call for him to reform Medicare, Social Security. This was Donald Trump on the campaign trail speaking on June of 2015 during his announcement speech.
Save Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security without cuts. Have to do it. Get rid of the fraud, get rid of the waste and abuse, but save it.
So he made promises to not only avoid touching Social Security and Medicare, but avoid touching Medicaid, which he is doing in this budget. Are you not concerned about the politics of what you're proposing?
I think it's actually a good thing that the president did go to make reductions in the federal share of Medicaid. That doesn't mean that states can't spend however much they want. States also are given a choice between a block grant or a per capita allotment. A per capita allotment, I think, would help to wall off funds for the most vulnerable populations that have suffered under the Medicaid expansion, as benefits have been diluted away from individuals with disabilities and others that are vulnerable towards a more expanded population. But I still think that Medicare, absolutely, it's one of the fastest growing programs. It suffers both from demographic as well as healthcare cost growth issues. And it's something that we need to address soon because we are heading towards a financial disaster. And we cannot save Medicare and Social Security without making changes to them. Both of them have trust funds that are set to expire by around 2030.
So in layperson's terms, what you're saying is we need to sort of cap the amount that the federal government gives to each state, and they can figure out who the dollars go to within those states to sort of save us money nationally.
Yes, because what we're seeing is that states tend to spend their own money that they have to collect from their own citizens more responsibly than the money that they receive from the federal government.
Let me take this now to Harry Stein. Harry, in practical terms, what we're describing, capping the amount of money from Medicaid that goes to states, It means people lose their health insurance.
Right. So states would have the option of spending more money on their own, but that means higher taxes at the state level or program cuts to things like education. And remember that state taxes tend to be paid more by working class people than they do, whereas federal taxes tend to be paid more by the wealthy. So this is a way of transferring the tax burden from the rich to working class people. Now, that said, I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people would lose their health insurance. You know, I just want to correct kind of the numbers on Medicaid because they're very confusing.
Right.
This budget starts with the 800 some billion dollars in cuts to Medicaid that were in the House health care bill. It then adds to that another roughly $600 billion in cuts on top of that. So these are well over a trillion, around $1.4 trillion in Medicaid cuts. By 2027, which is the last year of the Trump budget, they'd be cutting Medicaid in half. And this is a time when Medicaid is right now supposed to be covering 87 million people. So this is not just going after a few people. We're talking about tens of millions of people losing their health insurance. And this is Medicaid covers half of pregnancies, half of deliveries. Medicaid covers about two-thirds of nursing home care. So if we end up in a nursing home at some point, there's a very good chance that Medicaid is a program that's going to make sure that we get to be there.
Let's go to the phone lines. Alicia is calling in from Lakeland, Florida. Hi, Alicia. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I believe that Trump's budget basically amounts to a war on the poor. America doesn't need more tax cuts for wealthy or corporations. If they paid their fair share, the same amount that the average middle-class American pays, we would have free health care and better infrastructure. We don't need more money for the industrial-military complex. We need to take care of our most vulnerable people.
Alicia, thank you for the call. LJ is calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, LJ. What's your comment?
Yes. I'm a blind gentleman. I just make a brief couple of statements, and I have a question to close with. The gentleman talked earlier, Wilson, about living off of the government. I've been blind for 34 years. I taught myself computers approximately 15 years ago, and I became involved with corporate business doing some basic phone work. From that point, I was promoted to do sales. Through a long series of circumstances, I had 7 or 8 really good corporate sales jobs. I then went to a health therapy school for 1 year. And after I graduated, you know, I called all over the state, all over the country for jobs. As soon as you say you're blind, people that don't have disabilities have no idea the barriers and the problems that it takes to get a job. What jobs I did have, it took me hundreds and hundreds, literally, of phone call inquiries to get hired. Now, having said that, I have a question concerning the SSDI program. I've heard blurbs on different shows about, could you please comment or give me any feedback on the changes to the SS Disability Insurance Program? Thank you.
I appreciate your story and your perseverance. Is Nicholas, is this something you know about? Or
maybe a little too detailed. I may defer
I could
to my
talk
colleagues.
About it.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
in simple terms.
Yes. So the Social Security Disability Insurance Program, as it's currently structured, primarily gives out permanent benefits regardless of individual conditions. So you have a pool of people that have marginal or temporary conditions that does not include blindness, and that they're not effectively being helped with accommodations or return to work efforts. And so this budget suggests that the SSA, the Social Security Administration, try different approaches to help more people return to work. One of the proposals that is in the Congress that may have influenced this budget would institute a temporary benefit similar to what's available in the UK, Germany, and other countries that would provide a more needs-based benefit based on individual conditions with the clear expectation that this individual, unless their condition deteriorates or doesn't improve, will return to work. And then there will also be incentives to help them smoothly transition back into the workforce, including being able to work at a higher level while still continuing to keep cash and health benefits until they're fully settled in.
Thank you. I don't want to get into too much of the specific details of each program, so that's helpful. But Nicholas, can you try to bring us around for a moment before we go to a break? What is the next step? Mulvaney will testify, and then what?
Right. They'll send all of the cabinet secretaries down to the individual committee to talk about their specific parts of this budget. And then Congress will begin the long, drawn-out process of actually writing the laws that will implement these spending things. The deadline for that is the end of the fiscal year in September. If they figure it out, the government won't close. If they won't, we may have another government shutdown scare again. But this is, as I said, the beginning of a very long and detailed process.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, it's important to work with someone you can trust who has your best interests in mind. With Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence you need to make an informed decision. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the president's new budget, with sharp cuts for lower-income Americans, tax cuts for higher earners. The military and Homeland Security are winners, the Department of Education and the EPA among the losers. What do you think of all this? Are our priorities in the right place? When the president's budget director says the economy will grow so fast we won't feel the pain of the cuts, do you believe him? My guests are Nicholas Johnston, editor of Axios, Romina Boccia, deputy director of the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Economic Policy Studies, and Harry Stein, director of fiscal policy at the Center for American Progress. Harry, let me turn this to you. There's a lot of talk of tax cuts in this budget. If you could just, in the most basic terms, explain, there's some controversy over the way the tax cuts are credited to our growth.
Right. So there's a lot of talk of tax cuts, not a whole lot in the way of new details. But we already have some details from what President Trump talked about during the campaign. And the upshot of all of that is that the wealthiest people and the biggest corporations get huge tax cuts. Actually, a lot of working class people end up with tax increases, particularly single parents. Now, that tax plan, even though it raises taxes on so many working people, because the tax cuts for the wealthy are so big, we think it costs about $6 trillion over 10 years. That's what the independent analysis has tended to come to. They don't put a dime of that in their budget. They don't put any cost for their tax cuts in their budget. And if you ask them, they'll say, well, they'll say a lot of different things, but some version of economic growth will pay for it, so we don't need to worry. But then on top of that, they add an extra $2 trillion or so and say, oh, and also we get this deficit reduction from economic growth. So they're double counting magic beans here. Hmm. You shouldn't count them once, and they're counting them twice.
Let's listen to for a moment what some of the members on Capitol Hill are saying in response to this. Here is Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer at a press conference in Washington yesterday with other Democratic leaders slamming the president's budget.
The Trump budget takes a sledgehammer to the middle class and to working class Americans, lavishes tax breaks on the wealthy, and imagines all of the deficit problems away with fantasy math.
Well, you might expect that from a Democratic leader, but how about this? Speaking at Pete Peterson Fiscal Summit in Washington yesterday, Republican Senator John McCain said the president's budget was, quote, dead on arrival because it didn't increase spending enough.
The buildup that the president promised during the campaign, no, my friends, no, it's not there. And we are facing challenges on a level we haven't seen since the Cold War, and this budget is totally inadequate.
Totally inadequate because it doesn't increase defense spending to the degree he would like it. Nicholas, I mean, this seems pretty unfortunate politically. He doesn't seem to have a win on either side of the aisle.
Well, that gets back to one of the original things I said about budgets being aspirational. Presidents don't write any of these things. These are written in Congress. And John McCain has priorities, and Chuck Schumer has priorities, and 533 others have many priorities as well, which is why these will go to subcommittees and these will be hashed out. We just have very broadly what the president is hoping to achieve, and powerful lawmakers like John McCain who are going to go try and change it and bend it to their will.
So I'm going to ask a silly question, but if this is all sort of priorities and wish lists, why do we all spend so much time and attention caring about what the president puts in his budget? Does it matter?
I don't want to say we shouldn't have this radio show since I'm on it, but I mean, it is a big document, and he's the president, and these are him writing down in very specific ways for my sort of colleagues here to go line by line through and figure out what these spending priorities actually mean, to sort of beginning to put sort of in a cliched way meat on the bone of what he tried to say. And I, even for all the talk I have about that Congress will write these bills, they won't necessarily write from scratch. They will use, at least the president's allies, will use what's in this budget as guideposts for beginning to go forward as they begin to write specific policies. So it is very important to know what the administration wants and what the administration will push Congress in the direction of doing. And that's what this budget is.
And Jessica, can I just say, I think it's very misleading to refer to this kind of budget as dead on arrival. This is a budget that actually looks a lot like the budgets that Ryan has put forward, Speaker Ryan, in Congress. So Congress has voted for these kinds of cuts to Medicaid and food stamps. It may sound outlandish to cut Medicaid in half when it's supposed to be covering 87 million people. But remember that the House just passed a bill to make huge Medicaid cuts and that would take insurance away from, we think, about 24 million people. This is not outlandish. Trump and Congress can move in lockstep on this, at least on potentially a lot of the largest and most concerning cuts in here, and certainly the tax cuts for the wealthy and corporations.
Romina, you're most aligned with the proposal here. You support it. Do you think it has a good chance of surviving in some somewhat rough form we've seen it?
So we're looking forward to see the congressional budget and how they intend to use reconciliation this year, which is a budget tool that allows them to pass bills with a simple majority in the Senate. I think that will be telling. Right now, what we're hearing is that they are, in fact, considering a reconciliation bill that will cut taxes, but do so in a revenue-neutral manner. We'll see what that looks like. And then they would also pair it with certain cuts in means-tested and other mandatory spending programs. So we may see some of the cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and other programs in that bill. There's also other legislative deadlines, I think, where the president's budget becomes relevant, including this fall, the end of the fiscal year in September. And then also the debt limit threatens to bind later this year, and Congress will have to work with the president on a bill that can get his signature to deal with those deadlines. I think the budget presents a menu of options for what the president might support in those legislative battles.
Speaker Ryan yesterday expressed optimism that Congress will be able to present its own budget and get it passed. This is what he had to say.
We have a president that is giving us an actual balanced budget plan. It's a plan to produce economic growth. Clearly, Congress will take that budget and then work on our own budget, which is the case every single year. But at least we now have common objectives: grow the economy, balance the budget. So we are now on that common ground, and we will have a great debate about the details and how to achieve those goals.
Let's take some calls. Edwina is calling in from Lawrenceville, Georgia. Hi, Edwina. What's on your mind?
Hi, I just wanted to add a personal perspective to this. When I was a child, you know, my family received a lot of these services like welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, Medicare, after-school programs, school lunches. I can only imagine how it would impact a lot of parents, especially since our cost of living is going up. There's no such thing as really a living wage in the United States of America, so you know, I'm in a fortunate position where I don't have to rely on those programs, but I would never want to see them taken away from children who need these.
Thank you for your call and for sharing your story. Victoria now is calling in from Mount Horeb. Did I get that right, Wisconsin? Hi, Victoria.
Mount Horeb. Yeah. Hello, Jessica and guests. A lot of people have touched on what I've said already, so here's what I'm going to say. I am a liberal, as liberal probably as they get, but I fully believe in people being accountable for their own lives and making their own livelihood. But I do agree with the gap issue and the Medicaid for children to help them bridge that gap. Here's my problem, is the obscene rhetoric of the administration and in general the Republicans saying that these kinds of reforms will take the burden off the taxpayer, when in fact, your guests have said it a couple times, the taxes would be shifted to them at the state level. And when they say it could go into the private sector can support these programs, that's right back at the middle class taxpayer. So it's the obscene rhetoric twisting that around. And my biggest problem is the and he mentioned it about the, somebody mentioned it about the tax cuts for the upper tax earners and the 1%, is that they
All right, I think we've lost you, Victoria. Thank you. Thank you for the call. She is bemoaning the, you know, the way this language is twisted. I'll say that there is rhetoric that sometimes gets hot on both sides of the aisle. Here was Hillary Clinton yesterday in New York City reacting to the Trump budget. She was at an event for the nonprofit Children's Health Fund.
This budget, along with the relentless attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, shows an unimaginable level of cruelty and lack of imagination and disdain for the struggles of millions of Americans, including millions of children, every single day.
Ramina, what do you say to that?
I think that there's a lot of that's not true here. First of all, there is a serious question over where are those programs best managed. Is that at the state level or is that at the federal level? We never as a country agreed that the welfare state should be run out of Washington. We spend over $1 trillion in combined federal and state spending on a number of different welfare programs, including cash, food, housing, energy, and other assistance. And we have a $20 trillion national debt. And yes, I do think we need to find a balance between taxpayers, but also future taxpayers, because most of that spending right now comes on the backs of younger generations that have had no say over how these policies are working. But we also need to look at our middle class entitlements. It's not just about putting programs back on the states, but we need to look at our federal middle class entitlements, that's Medicare and Social Security, and make sure that those are also focused on the most vulnerable and don't pay unnecessary benefits to the wealthiest in society.
Ramina, may I just engage that for a moment? You are worried about the future generation's burden. This budget would also slash protections for student loans and kids who can't afford to pay it back despite working a lifetime. So if we're really worried about the welfare of kids in the future, how do you account for that?
I think one of the greatest tragedies is how we are pushing young people into debt. And part of that is because of the federal involvement in higher education, which has driven up administrative and tuition costs at universities in this country. And this budget, actually, President Trump supports a different model, more of an apprenticeship-based model, where students don't have to take on this large amount of debt. I would argue also that that should be handled on a state and private level and not through the federal government. But I think it's a start, and we need to come out of this thinking that everyone needs to go to college and needs to come out with a huge debt burden. What we're seeing is that people are delaying marriage, they're delaying buying their first homes, they're delaying buying their first cars because they can't afford it because they're so indebted, and we're not making it any easier by subsidizing the higher education complex, which has allowed them to raise prices and bring about these high debt burdens for our young people.
Harry, you're with the Center for American Progress. What's your response to that?
Well, let's be clear what they're actually going after on student loans. They would make borrowers pay interest on their student loans while they're in school. So you're in school, you're trying to just get good grades and pass your classes, and now apparently you're also expected to be paying your student loans. Well, you can't really probably do that. So what's going to be happening is those loans just accumulate more and more debt when you graduate. So it increases your debt. We've calculated that you could have borrowers paying $5,200 more over the life of their loan from that one change alone. And again, these are the kinds of things that we should be investing in. If we want people to be successful in the future, if we're thinking about future generations and growing the economy, we should be investing in education and investing in future generations.
And take a step back, if you would, Harry. She also suggested that this is a real budget that's a down payment on future generations. Why not reduce the debt burden on the next generation of Americans? Your response to that?
Well, this goes back to the phony numbers in the Trump budget. And all of that is designed to hide what's really going on here. This is not a budget about reducing the debt. Donald Trump ran for president on a platform that dramatically increased the debt. And the reason that they're hiding it is what they'll do is they will pass the tax cuts. I think the tax cuts probably come first after health care, which itself, the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, is a tax cut for the wealthy. They'll pass the tax cuts. They'll make the outlandish growth claims. And then when those don't materialize, make no mistake, they will turn around and say, because of these deficits that they created, now we have to go after programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We don't have to do that. As a caller mentioned earlier, we can also look at the revenue side of the budget and tax loopholes for the wealthiest people and big corporations. This is a budget that just pretends those aren't even an option and still just is basically a way to put through tax cuts and then try to kind of mask their true cost. The true cost of those tax cuts is even larger than the huge cuts that are contemplated in this budget.
Nicholas, Mick Mulvaney, the president's budget director, testifying on the Hill, said that to really balance the budget, it's going to require cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Now, the president left those big retirement programs alone in this year's effort, but as Harry just said, they are looking ahead to that.
Right. I think the president's budget director, Mulvaney, and the president that they have are a little bit of a different opinion on how to approach Social Security and Medicare, which is why I don't think it was part of this budget. But he's been very clear about saying in further years in the future that will have to be addressed. I'd like to circle back real quick to sort of Hillary Clinton's comments, though. And my response to that, not to be flippant or glib, is that elections have consequences. And there's nothing in this budget from Republican President Donald J. Trump that surprises me. The same way that if Hillary Clinton were president, she would release a budget that would have a completely different set of priorities. This is what this document is, a partisan political policy document that lays out this president's priorities. And a lot of these are priorities that he ran on and was elected president behind.
But it is worth remembering, Donald Trump promised he wouldn't cut Medicaid. He's making huge cuts to Medicaid. He promised he wouldn't cut Social Security. He is cutting Social Security. And to go back to the caller who was talking about the challenges that people with disabilities face, you just see that in the way that this budget is covered, as if Social Security disability isn't Social Security. You pay for it with your payroll taxes, just like you pay for the life insurance benefits that are also part of Social Security and the retirement benefits of Social Security. The program is called Social Security Disability, and yet people treat it as if somehow the disabled are less than everybody else in getting their benefits. They're not. Any of us could become disabled. That's why you pay payroll taxes into Social Security. And, you know, we've seen this rhetoric with Trump where he's mocked people with disabilities. He promised not to cut Social Security, so people voted for him if they believed that promise, and they got a very different agenda.
All right, I think we're going to have to leave the conversation there. There is a lot to chew over, and it sounds like we're going to have plenty of time to chew over it as this works its way through both the House, the Senate. They attempt to come to a final budget and face our national fiscal cliff. Nicholas Johnston is the editor of Axios. Nicholas, thanks for trying to help us work through all this.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Harry Stein is the director of fiscal policy at the Center for American Progress. Harry, thanks to you.
Good to be here.
And Romina Baccia, deputy director of the Heritage Foundation's Institute for Economic Policy Studies. Romina, we appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.